Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
By this time next week, history will be in the making. President Obama will be in Cuba, marking the first American presidential visit since Calvin Coolidge was there in 1928. Of course, Tim, it's a trip with all the pomp and circumstance of a presidential visit, but with the last vestiges of the Cold War colliding, really, with the 21st century change.
Next month will be 7 years since President Obama announced his executive action lifting travel and remittance restrictions for Cuban Americans between the U.S. and the island. It's been 15 months since the president set the course to reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba, and 8 months since the U.S. embassy reopened in Havana for the first time in more than a half century. It all leads to the president's 2-day trip to Cuba in a week.
I am very much interested in going to Cuba, but I think the conditions have to be right.
This is the president speaking with Yahoo News in December last year.
And what I've said to the Cuban government is if, in fact, I with confidence can say that we're seeing some progress in the liberty and freedom and possibilities of ordinary Cubans, I'd love to use a visit as a way of highlighting that progress.
The president won't be the only one looking for progress in Cuba when he visits. His critics will say detentions of Cubans have increased and there has been no progress secured toward more democratic or economic freedoms for Cubans since the president began his efforts. Now, in Congress, a bipartisan group of lawmakers will be looking for momentum to support their efforts to go further than President Obama and change decades of U.S. law governing our relationship with Cuba.
I'm Congresswoman Kathy Castor. I represent the Tampa Bay area in Congress.
Tom Emmer. I'm a congressman, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Minnesota's 6th Congressional District.
Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona.
A Republican senator from Arizona, Republican representative from Minnesota, and a Democratic representative from Tampa Bay. They make up the leading trio of federal lawmakers pushing for big changes in U.S. law toward Cuba, most notably, Tim, of course, their effort to end the American trade embargo.
And ending the embargo would be a monumental change in the relationship with Cuba. It dates back to Presidential Proclamation 3447, signed by President John Kennedy on February 3, 1962. 34 years later, in 1996, the trade embargo was codified into U.S. law. That statute, among other things, requires a change in government in Cuba before the U.S. embargo can be lifted. But a group of bills propose a range of actions, from further eroding travel restrictions between here and Cuba to eliminating the trade embargo. In the Senate, Arizona Republican Jeff Flake thinks the best chances for legislative success soon is not to vote to drop the embargo, but rather a more narrow bill that would drop all travel restrictions to the island for Americans.
I think moving on travel makes more sense. If we put my freedom to travel bill on the Senate floor tomorrow, we'd have 60-plus votes easily. And so it's very difficult to ask OFAC, or the Office of Foreign Assets Control at Treasury, to enforce a travel ban when there's so much legal travel going on. And pretty soon, the Americans have already, but the Congress will soon throw up its hands and say, why are we, you know, putting up this facade?
Flake thinks ending the travel ban first will make ending the embargo inevitable. But in the House, Democratic Representative Kathy Castor, along with her Republican co-sponsor, has a different strategy, going for a vote on a bill to repeal the entire trade embargo.
It's an audacious goal, and I think it's very difficult to accomplish a lot here in Washington these days unless you shoot for the moon. And now with the new momentum from the business community, the religious community, all the cultural arts groups that are traveling back and forth, the travel community, tourism sector, and the families now that want change, they've had a taste of it, but they want more. Yes, I think it is time to lift the embargo, and I do think it's entirely possible this session.
That assessment may sound surprising, especially considering this Congress is routinely criticized for being gridlocked, and with the Republican majority in the House accused of being obstructionist to any legislation the White House may support. But the Republican co-sponsor of the bill to end the trade embargo, Tom Emmer of Minnesota, thinks they will be able to muster support in the lame duck weeks after the November election, but before January, when a new Congress and a new president are sworn in.
It's threading the eye of a needle. So I don't want anybody to get the idea that this representative is touting, oh yeah, we're going to No, this is threading the eye of a needle, but is there a chance to get it done before the end of 2016? Yes, there is. It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take a lot of luck, but there is a way to get it done.
Now, Capitol Hill can be a deferential place. Seniority is rewarded with plum committee assignments, and some congressmen and women tend to stake out issues important in their districts with their colleagues deferring to their judgment. It has happened for years regarding Cuba. While South Florida's congressional delegation has voiced support for ending the embargo, Republican Representatives Mario Diaz-Balart and Ileana Ross Leighton have consistently said doing so without securing freedom for the Cuban people would be a mistake.
Yeah, but Tim, this bipartisan trio tells us they're pushing forward with or without support. Again, Republican Tom Emmer from Minnesota.
I don't think it's a matter of trying to change their minds. You got to respect them. You got to understand that they have personal experience, and this is something that is I don't have, being from the state of Minnesota. So from my perspective, it's just making sure that they know how much I respect them and their point of view. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor represents thousands of Cubans in her district in Tampa Bay. Now, she expects her effort to end the embargo eventually will get support from her colleagues in the House from here in South Florida.
I anticipate that they will eventually, because of the business community support, because of the churches and religious community, because of our cultural institutions, because of our neighbors and Cuban families.
But Capitol Hill is also a place dedicated to process. If there is to be any legislation making its way to Congress for a vote regarding travel or trade with Cuba, it's likely to come this summer when the House begins work on appropriations bills. Those bills must pass to keep the government running so they can attract a number of legislative ideas unrelated to spending. That's the strategy Republican Senator Jeff Flake expects will be used. If he's right, debate on Cuba would be happening just as the election cycle is entering its final months.
Whether or not that window closes when we inaugurate the next president depends on who we're inaugurating and depends on the composition of the House and the Senate. So I wouldn't venture to guess what that environment's going to be like.
So no guesses on the fate of the election or, for that matter, the fate of a particular vote. Still to come, more from Jeff Flake, the leading Republican voice in the United States Senate, pushing to end the Cuban embargo.
You know, as a Republican, it's just always struck me as odd that we talk about engagement and commerce and trade and travel as being good things, something that would, you know, nudge a country toward a democracy. But with Cuba, we say, no, it just doesn't work there.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
And I'm Tim Padgett. We are talking with a trio of federal lawmakers from outside South Florida who are leading the legislative efforts to change the American relationship with Cuba. Those efforts so far have involved presidential executive actions, easing travel, trade, and financial restrictions on how Americans can engage the island. Next week, President Obama is scheduled to visit Cuba for 2 days, marking a milestone in his efforts to normalize relations with Cuba.
Now, like most Americans who travel to Cuba, Jeff Flake remembers his first trip for as much as what happened on the trip as for what happened in the days following. It was September 2001. Flake at that time was a Republican congressman from Arizona. That first trip came the weekend before the September 11th terrorist attacks.
I was a Time magazine correspondent at the time, and I too was in Havana that weekend. I had a long talk with Flake at his hotel, and I was struck by how committed he seemed to the Cuba issue, even though neither he nor his constituents had much of any personal or financial stake in it. He just felt it was unconstitutional to tell U.S. citizens where they could and couldn't travel. Cuba, in fact, is the only country in the world where Americans are forbidden to go as tourists. One thing Flake remembers was the difficulty in finding any signs of private business.
One thing that struck me is, you know, we tried to find as many examples of free enterprise in Cuba as we could. And, you know, there was a farmer's market, and there were some things that we could find, but you had to look. Because, you know, in Cuba, government controls not just the commanding heights of the economy, they control the economy, the whole thing. And going and trying to find somebody asked if we wanted to get some ice cream. You know, the tourists can get it in hotels, but you know, just out on the street. So I had to wait in the park in a line that lasted for a couple of hours for one scoop of chocolate, and wait in another line for vanilla. And it was you know, the typical communist you know, experience. It's a much different place today. You can go down there, you can stay in a private home. And the average person pays about $250 to a private homeowner in that kind of arrangement. You eat in private restaurants if you want good food. Take a private taxi. You know, you get a sense that things are changing. And as much as the Cuban government would like to control more of what's going on, I think they've lost the ability to do so. And that's a good thing.
One of the things that struck me during our conversation back in 2001, I think it was in the Hotel Nacional, was that you seemed, your approach to engaging Cuba seemed quite a bit of an outlier at that particular moment in history. Now, 15 years later, it's the accepted norm. How would you describe the feeling of seeing a philosophy that 15 years ago did seem quite an outlier become, you know, the accepted foreign policy approach today?
Well, it's nice to, you know, at that point I had to go and endure the scolding of Karl Rove and others in the White House whenever I wanted to move forward with the Republican administration, to see, you know, just a much different attitude here on Capitol Hill, to see a lot of Republicans, you know, moving ahead quickly or tripping over themselves to engage more with Cuba. It's a great thing to see. It really is. We've come a long way.
Public opinion polls support Senator Flake's assessment. According to a 2015 Gallup poll, almost two-thirds of Americans support eliminating the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. 1 year after President Obama's change in policy toward Cuba, a survey of Cuban Americans nationwide found over half of those surveyed thought the embargo should end. But politics here, of course, Tim, still plays a role. Less than half of Republican Cuban Americans in that Ben Dixon Amandi poll supported eliminating the embargo.
Which makes Republican Senator Jeff Flake's push to change the U.S. policies toward Cuba that much more unique.
You know, as a Republican, it's just always struck me as odd that we talk about engagement and commerce and trade and travel as being good things, something that would, you know, nudge a country toward a democracy. But with Cuba, we said, no, it just doesn't work there. And it just seemed completely inconsistent to me, and glaring inconsistency in our foreign policy. So, and I thought that, you know, the debate was being dominated by those right close to home, the Cuban American community in Miami, or those with ag interests. I thought that it ought to be, you know, taken up by somebody who had none of those interests, just, you know, interested in the issue of freedom, particularly for Americans to travel there.
Is there an interest on the part of your constituents in Arizona, specifically with this engagement with Cuba, that you've been having that conversation first in the U.S. House of Representatives and now in the United States Senate for them?
Well, I often joke that I took a poll among Cuban Americans in my district and in my state, and both of them said, move right ahead. We like what you're doing. So it's not so much for parochial interest, but there is an interest in you know, just freedom to travel. And people want to go there. There's a lot of history in Cuba, you know, obviously the close-to-home Caribbean kind of history, but European history. And, you know, you have old forts dating back to the 1600s, and people who fought in the Spanish-American War, or our ancestors did, and, you know, so there's a lot of interest.
What changes have you seen most in Cuba since you and I first met there in 2001 and 15 years later?
Well, there, you know, through fits and starts, the Cuban government has allowed some private business to move forward, private restaurants, for example, in the 90s. But then when the economy improved, they pulled it back. They are famous for doing that, only allowing as much freedom as benefited them economically. The difference now is that you have a burgeoning private sector in Cuba, mostly since President Obama lifted restriction on Cuban-American travel and remittances.
in 2009. And that has led to a lot of investment with family members and others in Cuba, travel to support the kind of entrepreneurial activity that has been generated. And now you have, you know, up to 25% of the Cuban workforce outside of government. That's a huge change. When the average waiter in a private restaurant in Cuba makes between $40 and $60 a day, as opposed to about the same per month in a state restaurant. And the biggest difference you know, for them, a friend of mine interviewed a private restaurant owner a while ago and said, what is the biggest difference for to you? And he thought that she would say, well, now I get a big screen TV from my cousin in Miami or whatever. And she said, no, it's when the party bosses, you know, come by and say, you've got to attend a rally, I can tell them, go jump in a lake because they have nothing over me. They can't pull my ration card or anything else. And so it has improved the human rights situation and improved the quality of life for a lot of Cubans.
And to what extent do you feel President Obama's visit will accelerate that change that you're seeing?
I think it will. That combined with other things that are happening, signing of the Civil Aviation Agreement. Right now, DOT, the Department of Transportation, is deciding, you know, which airlines get which slots, you know, out of which cities. When you have direct scheduled flights, it'll make a big difference. When you can go to Cuba on frequent flyer miles and just pick one of the categories of travel, humanitarian or religious or educational or others. And we're still hoping for some other regulatory changes that the administration still can make, and I hope they do, to further broaden those opportunities. The president's visit will make a big difference. That, and also we're seeing other you know, business opportunities pursued. The tractor factory that'll be opening up. I know there's some in the hospitality industry and hotels. There are some things in the works. It's going to make a big difference.
What is your impression of the Cuban response that you've seen to the administrative actions the Obama administration has already taken? As you know, the opposition to engagement has pointed to these actions as losing leverage for the American side to extract from Cubans more human rights, more civil liberties, more economic liberties, as well as conversations around the payback of property that was confiscated during the revolution and the ability of U.S. law enforcement to go in and reach into fugitives for U.S. law who are residing in Cuba.
I see it completely different. We have gone 50 years without having leverage with the full-out embargo and travel ban. Only now will we have some leverage. I've always said in my first visit to Cuba in 2001 when I met with the foreign minister, I said, I'm going to go back, we're going to try to lift the travel ban, and if you don't improve your human rights situation, we're going to lift the whole embargo.
That quote ended up in Time magazine.
and that's how I felt, and that's what has bothered me when you've had administrations, Republican and Democrat, say, we'll only take measures, you know, commensurate with what the Cubans do in response, or we'll you know, demand this in exchange for doing this. When lifting the travel ban, that's simply removing a sanction on Americans, not Cubans, and we shouldn't expect something in return from the Cubans for allowing Americans to travel freely. But we do know that that will improve the human right condition and the quality of life for Cubans. We've seen it in spades here in the last 5 years with Cuban American travel, you know, and investment with relatives. It's a much better situation. So I just reject the premise that we ought to demand something for removing sanctions on Americans.
So let me ask you this then. With this new reengagement since mid-December of 2014, with the administration taking the actions that it has, what gives you the confidence to continue to lower those barriers and the Cuban response that is either very public or, for that matter, what you've been able to discern as your position as a leading senator?
Well, the Cuban government, I think sometimes they want more engagement, sometimes they get spooked.
And we've seen that over the past decade and a half. We got close to lifting the travel ban. All of a sudden, they jail, you know, a bunch of dissidents. Now we remove restrictions on American exports, but they still won't allow a wholesale market there because they want to keep that kind of control. And so I think that that, you know, for us to expect or try to only do something that's in our national interest, if we do something that we perceive to be in the Cubans' interest, is not the way to go. We want freedom for the Cuban people. We want them to have a better quality of life. And I think that is best done by removing restrictions on American travel and commerce in Cuba. I think the events of the past several years have borne that out. And I think that we will only get more leverage to deal with issues like you know, the property and the claims issues as we have diplomatic relations and are able to engage with the Cubans on these issues. There's going to be some big issues in terms of migration, drug policy, environmental issues in the Florida Straits. And those things, we have a better ability, not a perfect ability. The Cuban government's still tough to deal with sometimes, often. But we have a better opportunity when we have full diplomatic relations and have more of a commercial relationship as well.
Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake, the sponsor of several proposed bills that would further lift travel restrictions between the U.S. and Cuba and end the trade embargo.
Still to come on our program, the Republican leading the effort to drop the embargo in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Are there communists in Cuba? Sure. And is the government still controlled by the Castros? It appears so. But I was introduced to the Cuban people, who clearly are hungry to be exposed beyond Cuba.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week.
And I'm Tim Padgett. A week from today, President Obama is scheduled to wake up in Cuba, becoming the first U.S. president to visit the island since 1928. The visit is a culmination of secret diplomacy leading to the public reestablishment of relations.
Now, it was 15 months ago when the president announced his effort to normalize relations with Cuba. Since then, travel, financial, and some trade restrictions have eased, with critics complaining America has not secured more freedoms for the Cuban people in return. Tom Emmer's first trip to Cuba came after the president's announcement. It was May 2015, 6 months after President Obama announced that shift in U.S. policy toward Cuba after more than 50 years of isolation. Emmer went again in February of this year. As a self-described kid from Minnesota, Emmer says his familiarity with the communist island was around agriculture and the limited trade of U.S. ag products into Cuba, but that was about it.
I personally was not familiar with anything beyond that. And beyond the history as it is taught to us in this country about the Castro regime and what's happened to the Cuban people.
Emmer is a U.S. congressman. He represents Minnesota's 6th District that stretches northwest from Minneapolis. He is a Republican in a traditionally Democratic state. He's now one of the leading voices in the U.S. House of Representatives to drop the trade embargo against Cuba. On that first trip he made to Cuba back in the spring of 2015, he says he went with what he describes as a blank slate, with a Cold War mentality. But he saw something different.
Are there communists in Cuba? Sure. And is the government still controlled by the Castros? It appears so. But I was introduced to the Cuban people, who clearly are hungry to be exposed beyond Cuba. You've got a attitude and a welcoming in the Cuban people for Americans that I guess I did not expect to see when I was there in May. Now, fast forward, I was there just a couple of weeks ago, and I think there are dramatic changes. And my educational experience expanded dramatically, probably because of my initial exposure and the work I've done over the last 8 months. I left last May knowing that lifting the embargo is not only important to our country. I mean, you start out by talking about if it's about the Cuban people, because that's what I hear from my colleagues, right, who are concerned with human rights, who are concerned with other issues that directly relate to the quality of life for the average Cuban, not the average political elite in Cuba, but the average Cuban. I left knowing that lifting the embargo is going to help the average Cuban. That was the most important thing to me. If you truly want to help the Cuban people, if you truly want to give them an opportunity someday to self-determine, to address the human rights issues, it all starts with lifting the embargo.
Emmer is now the Republican sponsor of legislation in the House that would repeal more than a half century of U.S. policy toward Cuba and remove the trade embargo. Emmer's interest in Cuba is recent, but his second trip to the island a month ago worked to steel his effort and boost his faith that dropping the embargo was the right strategy.
If you look at where they're at in terms of the process, Cuba, by the government's admission, is now about 70% government-controlled economy and 30% private. By some estimates, there are as many as 600,000 private businesses currently operating today in Cuba. And the government, I think, is in this transition. I think it's obvious by looking at it. I believe the government in Cuba, maybe it's Raul Castro, maybe it goes beyond Raul Castro, but they have figured out it's a lot easier to incent people to create and grow opportunities for themselves and then tax them than it is to control their every move.
What did you witness in the spring of 2015 or in February of 2016 that gives you the confidence that that is taking root but is also sustainable?
Two things that I can say to you, which this is not a perfect science, so someone can certainly criticize me for my subjective reaction. But one, more openness. In 8 months, meeting with government officials in May of 2015, defensive, closed, edgy, suspicious, meeting with the same government officials 8 months later, more open, giving us facts specifically about the sales of cell phones to Cubans. Cubans, not just government officials, but Cubans now, 8 months later, being open enough to tell us about something called the package, right?
How people trade internet information when you don't have the internet. They trade it on a USB drive.
Exactly. So that's what's changed. And you ask me how I know. I don't. But you can see it's palpable. You can feel it. The people are moving in a direction where they want more, and they're going to demand more. So it gets us to the embargo once again. This time I left knowing the embargo today in Cuba is being used by the government to explain everything that goes wrong, everything that is not available, why you are not allowed to have what you aspire to, right? Why do you take the embargo away? Well, from my perspective, it's to empower the Cuban people. It's economic and national security reasons on our side, but even more importantly, to accelerate this process, because if you lift the embargo, you take away the government's ability to say, I'm sorry there are no potatoes available today, that's the Americans' fault. I'm sorry that there's no nails for your construction, it's the Americans' fault. You suddenly, you really stimulate this conversation within Cuba about what Cubans want from their government.
It certainly stimulates the conversation in South Florida as well. And with your Republican congressional colleagues in South Florida, they will push back and say, you'll be dropping the embargo and not getting any human rights, not getting any freer liberties in return for the Cuban people.
Well, and look, we've got great members from my Republican conference in Southern Florida, and I would never pretend to know more than they do. This isn't a direct statement that would refute where they're coming from. But what I would say to you is, how have we fixed the human rights issues with the embargo? How have we addressed these problems with the embargo? The embargo is now as old as I am. I mean, we're talking 55 years old, and it's been there. It hasn't changed. It hasn't addressed these very problems. And I do agree. Yeah, you want to see something back in the negotiations, but there are some significant negotiations that are going to continue and need to have resolution, not the least of which is the property claims, outstanding property claims. Another one would be harboring fugitives. The human rights issues will continue, but again, it's this mentality that we have, and this is a kid from Minnesota now telling you this, so I can't walk in the shoes of someone from South Florida, all right, and I wouldn't pretend to. But I would say to you that we seem to have this American, this U.S. mentality that we can tell you better how to do your business instead of empowering the very people that we think we're helping to do it for themselves. Lifting the embargo would literally empower the people on the street in ways that they haven't been empowered in many years in Cuba.
Congressman, as you know, the opponents say with an economy that's 70% controlled by Castro Inc. by the government, it'll also empower the very power structure that has held down the Cuban people for better than a half century.
Well, here's the problem I have with that argument. I mean, I've been there now. I've seen something that I did not expect to see in such stark contrast. What I've seen, the political elite, they live in what looks like suburban Dallas. They live in what looks like suburban Minneapolis, St. Paul. I mean, they live in big homes, well-maintained homes with well-manicured lawns and boulevards that are lined with beautiful trees. You know what? They're going to do well with or without an embargo. If that's what your argument is, then literally you're empowering those people to keep doing what they're doing, because the embargo is what they use to tell all those that don't have what they have, hey, I'm really sorry you can't climb the ladder of success and have the quality of life that we have, because it's the blockade.
That word is a loaded one when it comes to U.S.-Cuban relations. It's the way Cubans describe what Americans call the embargo. Hearing a Republican U.S. congressman use it may be a bit jarring, but Emmer's willingness to borrow the Cuban terminology for the trade embargo for an interview with a South Florida media outlet is another indication of the strengthening anti-embargo sentiment on Capitol Hill. Still to come as our program continues, Representative Emmer's legislative partner in the effort to lift the Cuban embargo. It's a Florida Democrat.
The entrepreneurial spirit is alive and well in Cuba, so we have an opportunity here in America to continue to empower those entrepreneurs and small business people, or we can stick with the status quo.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. It's Congress and Cuba today. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Tim Padgett. We are talking with three members of Congress who are leading the legislative effort to open up relations with Cuba even more dramatically than President Obama has. Public opinion polls indicate Americans and even Cuban Americans increasingly oppose the 56-year-old trade embargo. But Tom, the first Florida lawmaker to call for lifting the embargo wasn't from South Florida. It was Congresswoman Kathy Castor.
Yeah, Tim, she represents Florida's 14th congressional district. That includes Tampa Bay and St. Petersburg. Now, she was born here in Miami, but raised in Tampa Bay. She's been a congresswoman since 2006. Her first trip to the island came about 2 years before President Obama began taking executive actions to ease restrictions on travel and trade. She returned and publicly supported ending the embargo and making it easier for Cuban families in her district to get through what she calls the bureaucratic red tape between people.
For a long time, it was a disaster trying to get a grandchild to come visit their grandmother, or a brother and sister who had a related health issue, to try to work through approval by a certain embassy and a certain State Department, when we don't force that upon any other country in the world, really. We don't make it that difficult, especially a country that's 90 miles away, that where we have such close ties.
Just last month, Florida Representative Kathy Castor led a delegation of seven American lawmakers to Cuba as part of her efforts to build support for doing away with the trade embargo. Here she is again speaking with us at her congressional office on Capitol Hill.
What has given you confidence, tangible confidence, that some of the thresholds of change that the administration pointed out when the president began the normalization process in December of 2014, movement toward human rights, movement toward more economic liberties, what's the tangible qualities that you've seen in Cuba toward those goals?
I met Barbara Fernandez, who is a small business owner in Havana, who under the economic reforms has been able to open a business making baby clothes and guayaberas. So she scoured her neighborhood for old sewing machines, learned how to sew. This is a woman that used to work for the Cuban government inserting plastic medicine bottles into a cardboard box. She has higher goals and aspirations for herself than just filling a cardboard box. And she now has been able to travel to America because a part of the reforms, Cubans can leave. She's been able to go to Miami, buy materials that she needs, bring them back to Cuba, and make these baby clothes. She has now been able to save enough money to buy a new home for her two children and husband to live in that is a world away from the one-room home that she used to have. And the entrepreneurial spirit is alive and well in Cuba. So we have an opportunity here in America to continue to empower those entrepreneurs and small business people, or we can stick with the status quo that has left most of the Cuban people still with the very limited opportunities.
Now, you've made the point that opponents of lifting the embargo are underestimating the changes that have taken place in Cuba. All that said, however, is there anything that you see that the Cubans could do within this time frame before the end of the year to help those of you lobbying and advocating for lifting the embargo out in your efforts?
Of course, the Cuban government is too slow. They're too cautious right now. And I'll give you one example. There's a Tampa-based company called Florida Produce that has been importing fruit and vegetables into Cuba for years. They would like the Cubans to allow them to own a warehouse so that they can store fresh fruit and vegetables. The Cubans haven't acted fast enough on a proposal. And that's a fairly modest proposal in an area where Cubans would really benefit because they have such a shortage of fresh food. That's one example. So yes, the Cubans have a responsibility. Another area is telecommunications. When we met with the Cuban state telecom company, they were entirely too closed off. And yes, they politely answered some of our questions. And they did say, our goal is to have Wi-Fi and broadband available all across the island. And with 3 million cell phones just over the past couple of years being put into the hands of Cubans, they see what the future is, but they're too cautious and too slow because we know that American telecom companies are ready and willing to help them quickly expand Wi-Fi and broadband across the island.
We know that reparations are being talked about. We imagine that the harboring of U.S. fugitives is probably being talked about. Those are two points of contention for the opposition to drop the embargo. The opposition sees the embargo as significant leverage for the Castro regime and the Cuban government in general to loosen up human rights, civil liberties, economic rights, but also really put pressure on the Cuban government for property reparations, for persecution reparations for Cuban Americans during the revolution, and also open up Cuba so that the long arm of the U.S. law can get in there and grab what law enforcement says are fugitives to U.S. law. Do you anticipate any public movement toward those types of goals that have been set out from the beginning of this process by the administration?
You know, I've been pleasantly surprised that the United States State Department and the Cuban government are saying, yes, settlement of outstanding claims and reparations are on the table, and we're going to set up a process to work through those. That, frankly, I'm surprised by that because I thought that would be much too difficult a nut to tackle. I've talked to businesses in the Tampa Bay area that have many of those perfected claims, and they really don't expect to get paid. They don't really anticipate a monetary settlement. What they would like is an opportunity for joint ventures and new business opportunities on the island. And I think if the Cubans are willing and they have the capacity to do that, I just don't know if they have enough capacity and expertise to be able to work through those kind of things in the short term.
Do you mean financial capacity?
I mean just the expertise, the technical ability to sit down with folks who have those type of claims to say, what are you interested in? What would you be willing to discuss? And I think that's going to be difficult. But I am, like I said, I've been surprised at the seriousness on both sides, the American side and the Cuban side, to say, yes, that we are going to work on this.
Tampa Bay Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor.
And still to come on our program, the White House returns to Cuba after 88 years.
You will certainly be meeting with dissidents. And we've made clear from the very beginning of any discussion about a trip that the president would take that we select who we meet with. And that will be the case during the president's trip to Cuba.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy today. It's Congress and Cuba on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
And I'm Tim Padgett. 1 week from today, President Obama will be on Cuban soil. His itinerary includes a major speech, meeting Raul Castro, and talking with political dissidents. In a letter read by Ladies in White leader Berta Soler in Havana, the president promised the group he would raise the issues of freedom of speech and freedom to assemble when he meets with the Cuban leader. The Ladies in White have been critical of the new U.S. policy of engagement, and short-term detentions of Cuban government critics have increased. As part of the public relations around the visit, the president's deputy national security advisor, Ben Rhodes, spent Friday in Miami meeting with groups from the local Cuban-American community, hearing their concerns and their hopes for the trip.
He will certainly be meeting with dissidents. And we have made clear from the very beginning of any discussion about a trip that the president would take that we select who we meet with. And that will be the case during the president's trip to Cuba.
Now, Rhodes told us the White House continues to see, quote, the same troubling practices we've always seen, end quote. But the administration has been encouraged by what it calls higher expectations by the Cuban people.
Back to those critics for a moment here, Tim, because the critics of Obama's policy here in South Florida argue the White House has not gotten enough in return for reducing the travel, trade, and financial restrictions on doing business with the island. The administration has a list of ideas it thinks Havana could do, including things like creating a legal framework for foreign investment into Cuba, creating the ability for foreign firms to hire Cubans directly, and also access to a wholesale market on the island. Now, obviously, these really sound like kind of dry and bureaucratic items, certainly, and they are, but they're also fundamental to achieving the bigger goal of the Obama administration, which is deeper economic engagement with Cubans themselves outside of the part of the economy, the major part of the economy in Cuba, controlled by the Cuban government. The White House advisor Ben Rhodes put it this way in Miami. The White House would like the president's trip to advance normalization and serve as an accelerant so normalization is an irreversible process.
I will never understand this as well as you do, and I will never feel it as viscerally as you do. But what I can tell you is that we want to get to the same place. It is not about Cuba's a fun place to visit.
Rhodes also said he thinks the Cubans want to show the U.S. their own version of progress on normalization.
So, Tim, let me ask you, what could that be? What is it that the Castro regime would like to show President Obama?
I think one of the first things they want to show him is that, yes, it is possible, even without the trade embargo lifted so far, that it is possible for U.S. companies to do business on the island. One of the things they want to showcase, I think, is the fact that this small Alabama tractor factory in the United States is going to be opening up a factory in Cuba, the first U.S. factory to be opened there since really the 1940s or 50s, and it'll be in opening up in this special economic or special development zone near the port of Mariel. That's one. I think another one where they want to show that normalization is progressing is on the environmental field. Mm. Recently, the United States and Cuba signed the first accord that has to do with normalization, and it involves what they call sister sanctuaries, right. Marine sanctuaries that could really help the United States and Cuba understand better the eco drama going on in the waters of the Florida Straits and help us maybe save our reefs.
The environment and the economy are places where the two may see some more bilateral advancements. According to the Wall Street Journal, in terms of economics, we expect some U.S. companies to possibly announce some big deals. Hotel and resorts company Starwoods, we've got Marriott and AT&T. If these happen, can both the president and the Cuban government declare them as victories?
I think so, because again, even without the trade embargo lifted, both governments are showing that it is possible to wedge some business deals into this process, especially with some big guns. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, you've got this small tractor factory. That's symbolically, that's a big deal. But when you've got Starwood, Marriott, AT&T.
Ma Bell.
Yeah, and down the road, we could see companies like Caterpillar making similar agreements. That's the kind of stuff they want to put forward.
So how could this trip impact the congressional effort that we've heard over the last hour to reduce or eliminate the remaining travel and trade restrictions?
It'll have a big symbolic and psychological effect. We keep talking about the psychological effect that President Obama's visit will have in Cuba. For example, there are many polls out there that show he's a more popular figure on the island than even the Castro brothers.
Second only to the Pope.
Well, and I think that kind of psychological effect could convey itself into the United States as well. Having the President of the United States, as we've said before, on Cuban soil for the first time in 88 years, that lends sort of an aura of inevitability to the eventual elimination of the trade embargo and any other restrictions between the U.S. and Cuba and their relations.
Tim, the White House and the president have done like two or three tranches of restriction easing on travel and trade and business. Can they do anything more ahead of this trip?
Not much, really, but I do think we're going to see one more tranche. We're expecting to hear in the days before the president's visit to Cuba that there will be some more cuts of restrictions, including, for example, giving Cuba more access to direct U.S. dollar transactions. Now, it sounds a little dry and wonky, but it's important to the Cubans because up to now, they've had to take this very roundabout way of doing transactions that involve the U.S. companies. This will make it much easier for them to make those dollar transactions. Another one is giving individuals a lot less red tape to deal with when they want to do people-to-people trips, cultural exchanges, things of that nature into Cuba. This will make it much easier for an individual to get a visa to go into Cuba.
The trip concludes with a baseball game, Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban national team, but the White House has been careful to say this trip is not about baseball. It's not just about having fun.
Well, there's been a lot of criticism of his plans to attend this baseball game. But again, you got to go back to the symbolic nature of what he's doing. I mean, because he is so popular and because baseball is so popular in Cuba, to have him in that stadium, I think will do a lot to push what this normalization effort is trying to achieve.
You will hear about the trip throughout the next week and the following week, for that matter, here on WLRN. That's Tim Padgett. I'm Tom Hudson. Wanda Miles is our technical director here on the Sunshine Economy. Thanks again for listening this week.